I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Elon Musk has owned Twitter for a week, and in that time has sacked top executives and told the social media company's 7,500 employees not to come to the office today and to check their company or personal email to see if they still have a job. He paid $44 billion for Twitter that most analysts say is worth much less. He'll have to pay $1 billion in interest payments on the loan he took out and figure out how to turn a profit. He told advertisers that the platform will not become a, quote, free-for-all hellscape. Yet there's been a surge in hate speech on Twitter in the week since Musk became the boss. He met with civil rights leaders this week to hear their concerns. So what will the richest man in the world do with this platform with its 240 million users worldwide? One key question is whether former President Trump will be let back on the site. He was suspended after the January 6th insurrection. We have two guests who have joined us. Will Oremus is technology reporter for The Washington Post. And Will, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be on. Thanks.
You're very welcome. And also with us is Izzy Lipowski, and she's chief correspondent for Protocol, covering the intersection of technology, politics, and national affairs. Izzy, you were a guest a couple of months ago, and we were talking about Elon Musk. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, we want to hear from you. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Yes, you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Well, let me begin with you. What are you hearing from Twitter employees today?
Yeah, it's been quite a ride for them over the past several months since Musk launched his bid to buy the company. Yesterday at Twitter, it was a funereal atmosphere on their internal Slack channels. That's the way they communicate. Twitter is a company where a lot of people work remotely, and so these internal message boards are really sort of the heart of the company. They've been going quiet ever since Musk took over. Yesterday, they were filled with people posting tearful goodbyes and sharing contact information. There was also an effort, we heard from some employees, to make all of their internal documents shareable so that those left behind would have access to them and not be siloed off as they try to pick up the ball and move forward.
Do we know, Issy, how many people Elon Musk actually wants to lay off?
The reports have said that, you know, it could be, you know, half of the company. So obviously he is looking to make really big slashes to the company's budget and is kind of desperate to find new ways to make money. Because as you mentioned, this company has taken on a whole lot of debt in Eli's quest to take it over. And so these cuts are really deep.
Really deep. Well, obviously, if you're talking about laying off half the company, and I'll go back to you, Issy, he also laid off a number of top executives. This was about a week ago.
Right. I mean, that was one of his first moves, really, before he'd said word one to anybody at the company, laying off the company's CEO, laying off the CFO, laying off the head of trust and safety, basically all of the top brass at the company, not the head of trust and safety, the chief policy and counsel. And so basically all of the top brass at the company was gone pretty much overnight. And what you saw shortly after that were a number of resignations from sort of the next tier of leadership, the chief marketing officer and others who all, I think, saw where the winds were blowing.
And Will, a number of people have remarked on the letter, I guess the email that went out to Twitter employees, and it was signed not by Elon Musk or any human being. It was signed Twitter.
That's right. It was a very impersonal letter, the letter announcing the layoffs. And interestingly, since Musk took charge of the company, until that letter announcing the layoffs yesterday, there had not been a single official communication from anyone in leadership to the staff. So the staff of Twitter weren't even told that Musk had taken charge. They weren't told that their CEO had been fired. They weren't told about product plans that Musk was announcing on Twitter. And so they quickly learned that they had to follow Musk's public tweets to figure out what was going on at the company and what his vision might be. They also started using anonymous workplace gossip apps to try to trade information so they could figure out what the heck was going on.
Does anyone want to work for Elon Musk at Twitter, Will?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Elon Musk is a business legend. He has helped to build two of the big success stories of the 21st century in American business, in SpaceX and Tesla. There are lots of people who are probably thrilled to work for Elon Musk, but I will say that most of the people I hear from at Twitter are extremely dismayed with his public statements and his actions ever since he launched the bid, and especially since he took charge of the company. The atmosphere inside the company has been described to me as poisonous, chaos, psychological warfare, silent treatment. So it's been pretty much a disaster, and I think that the number of people who are thrilled to work for Musk, at least at Twitter, are vastly outnumbered right now by the ones who would rather do anything than work for Elon Musk.
Well, indeed. And is he, maybe it's too soon to know from all these layoffs sort of what his vision then for Twitter will be with the remaining employees or whoever else he might bring in into the company.
I think the remaining vision is do whatever they can to make money. So we're already seeing him talk, you know, mostly about this new $8 for verification wrapped up into Twitter Blue, which will include a whole bunch of other features that will allow verified users to get prioritized in replies and basically be boosted on the platform, where now a lot of that boost comes from sort of algorithmic recommendations and who you follow and who you engage with. It looks like we're tilting more toward a pay-to-play operation where Twitter is making, you know, $8 wherever it can, and those people are reaping the benefits, which obviously tilts the scale towards people who have the funding to do that, people who are at this point willing to pay Elon Musk's company that amount of money to keep for the honor of saying I am who I say I am. And so what you're going to see is a lot more paid product. Will reported on some efforts to get a paid video product in place. So it seems like wherever they can make money, that's where they're going to do it.
Yeah, Will, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so a lot of the plans that Musk has been forming for Twitter, he has announced publicly on Twitter. But I got wind of one that had not been announced. The company is working on a paid video product where users could post a video but then hide it from other users and charge money, $1, $2, $5, $10, for them to be able to watch that video. The sources I talked to are pretty sure that's going to be used mostly for adult content, for pornographic videos. And so the company, there was an email that went out inside the company to the people who are tasked with reviewing a product that's in development to see what the risks or what the downsides might be. They wanted to do that on a very rushed timeline. They were hoping to launch the product in just 1 to 2 weeks. They were giving those internal reviewers just 3 days to weigh in on what the downsides might be, even though the product had internally been deemed high risk because of the potential for copyrighted content. Twitter had also earlier this year developed and then shelved a product that involved adult content. And the reason that they ultimately shelved it after lots of stress testing and internal review was that they determined that they wouldn't be able to ensure that there would be no child pornography monetized on the platform. That would obviously be illegal, could get Twitter in a lot of trouble. And so they gave up on it. But now, under Musk, it looks like they're going to move much faster on these types of products. They're not going to worry so much about the risks. They're just going to go ahead and do it.
Well, and he's obviously working at lightning speed, but, you know, are advertisers going to want to advertise on Twitter if it becomes a porno site or in part a porno site?
Yeah, I think we're already seeing advertisers get really jittery and nervous. You're seeing big agencies, you know, put out the call to all of their clients, which include really, really big companies, Unilever and other, you know, major companies that represent big brands, and saying, you know, watch this space. You know, we need to make sure that we're putting brand safety first. And I think one thing that's pretty telling in all of this is one of the only, you know, earnest things that Elon Musk has said since he took over was, you know, putting out this sort of message to advertisers saying, we don't want this to become a hellscape. Because, you know, as I went back to, even as he's trying to make money from subscriptions and from video and all of these other, you know, individual things that he can charge users for, advertising is still his bread and butter, and he needs to make a lot of money, and he cannot lose all of his advertisers. So I think you're having advertisers, you know, feel pressure from the civil rights community, which has put out the call, you know, that they, you know, if they see any rollback of content moderation on the platform, that they pull their business. And that would not be unprecedented. We've seen big groups of advertisers boycott platforms like Facebook at times where they felt like the risk to the brand was too great to continue advertising there. And so I think we'll definitely have to watch and see. And, you know, Elon can say that we don't want this place to become a hellscape, but when you lay off half of the company and the folks responsible for ensuring that the platform is safe and encouraging healthy discussion and all the things they've been talking about all of these years, how much are you really demonstrating your commitment to the words you're saying?
Well, and Will, it's shortly after he talked about, I don't want this place to be a hellscape, obviously wanting to appeal to advertisers, then Musk retweets a completely discredited, irresponsible tweet about House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul Pelosi, who had been seriously injured by an intruder in their San Francisco house. Now, he did take down his tweet, but nonetheless, you know, on the one hand, he's telling advertisers don't worry, and then he does this.
Right. So Musk is not just the owner of Twitter. He's also a customer.
He's a Twitter user, yes.
Exactly. He's a Twitter addict. And he has what some terminally online people call posting disease. He cannot stop himself from tweeting every thought that comes into his mouth, into his brain, it seems, at times. And in this case, he posted a sort of just asking questions reply to a tweet where he linked to an article advancing a conspiracy theory about Paul Pelosi. The article was from an outlet that is basically a conspiracy outlet and has been sort of widely discredited. Musk did take the tweet down, which shows that, you know, it's not that he doesn't care. He's getting the message that if he is amplifying conspiracy theories on Twitter, that that's going to spook advertisers. You know, he's really got this central tension in his ownership of Twitter, which is that he bought it on the premise that it should be a place for free speech where basically anybody can say anything. He has spent the past few months and the past week finding out in a hurry that why that's not the case on social media today, right? There are very good reasons why that's not how social media works. And he's kind of running into those one by one. And, you know, I think it will affect how he tweets. But I also think in some cases he won't be able to help himself. I mean, he likes the idea of challenging the status quo, of challenging the consensus. He doesn't always sort of trust the mainstream media consensus. You know, there's obviously value in having social media platforms where Sure. people can challenge the consensus. At the same time, there's a risk that social media platforms become sort of weaponized by scammers or by foreign influence operations who are deliberately sowing misinformation. And that's the real challenge of online content moderation.
And that's Will Oremus. He's technology reporter for The Washington Post. Issy Lepowski is chief correspondent for Protocol. We're talking about the news of the day, not just that Elon Musk bought Twitter, but he's laying off a lot of employees. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. As we all know, Elon Musk bought Twitter last week for $44 billion. Well, today he's laying off a sizable portion of the workforce. We're talking with our guests about what the richest man in the world wants to do with this social media platform. And again, our guests are Issy Lepowski and Will Oremus. And we got a lot of comments here. Let me just tell folks how they can join our conversation. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call that phone number 1-888-477-9499. See, let me just pick up on something that Will was saying right before the break, that, you know, Elon Musk's vision of Twitter as a place for free speech. But if you work for Elon Musk, do you have those same rights?
Well, that's a good question. In that memo that was circulated to everybody, letting them know that the layoffs were coming, you know, it was a very brief memo and it wasn't very compassionate or empathetic. But the one thing they did make sure to remind folks was that Twitter's policy is that they don't speak publicly about internal internal goings on or to the press about it. And so, no, I think that is clearly not how Elon runs his companies. He has been, you know, pretty against leakers. He has, you know, at Tesla laid off their entire public relations team. So the idea that, you know, companies, you know, should or have some responsibility to, or even the freedom to talk openly about what's going on inside the company, I think he is pretty opposed to that. Obviously, you know, Twitter has a very open culture. And one reason why I think a lot of reporters have seen what's going on before Elon was communicating that to the company is because, you know, there were so many leaks coming out and people were tweeting openly about what was going on. They were tweeting memes, you know, they were fairly, you know, in it seemed like in fairly good spirits, or at least, you know, ready to sort of poke fun at themselves online. And so, you know, unsurprisingly, a lot of those folks are no longer at Twitter.
Well, Will, here's a related comment from James, who says Musk is all about freedom of speech, and yet he's cut off all his employees from their email. And now the platform will be filled with speech detrimental to our democracy. Do you share some of James's concerns as he writes?
Well, I think he's getting at the tension in this idea of freedom of speech. I mean, you know, in the U.S. we have the First Amendment, which protects us all from censorship by the U.S. government. It does not necessarily ensure that we can say whatever we want in a private business or in on a social media platform that's owned by a company. And so the history of social media has been, in one sense, a history of private companies trying to figure out what should be the bounds of what people can say online and what they can't. I think Musk really fell in love with the idea of a neutral social media platform that just wouldn't take sides and wouldn't censor you for your political views. And it would really be a haven for free speech, not only in the United States, where our free speech is, again, protected under the Constitution, but around the world, where there aren't those kinds of protections. But you quickly run into the fact that if almost every other venue in society is a place where there are things you can't say, like you can't say hateful slurs, right? Racial slurs. Right. You can't say things that are anti-Semitic in polite company without being shunned or getting people angry or offended. If you run a social media site where you can say all those things, guess who is going to come flocking to that site? And that's what we saw the first day Musk took over. He hadn't changed any policies. He hadn't laid off anybody yet. Twitter still had its full content moderation staff. And yet there was a report that said the use of the N-word on Twitter skyrocketed by 500% on the first day of Musk's ownership because he had given that signal to all the racists, all the trolls, all the worst people. Hey, this is a place for you. Come out and say what you feel.
And they did. You see, he met with civil rights leaders earlier this week. Was that a fruitful conversation?
You know, I spoke to some of the folks who met with him, and they said, you know, he was in listening mode, he was earnest, and he seemed to agree with everything that they said. And they really wanted to hammer home a few points. They wanted to ensure that, you know, that Twitter wouldn't re-platform anybody who had been removed from the platform or banned from the platform until it really had a clear process in place. He agreed with that. He tweeted publicly that that is his commitment. They wanted him to commit not to allow election lies and election misinformation to flourish. They said that he agreed with that. And they wanted to ensure that, you know, as he creates these clear processes and creates this content moderation council that he's talked about, that they really include the voices of folks who have been on the other end of hate-fueled violence, that they include voices from the civil rights community. And he committed to that. And so, you know, they were encouraged that he committed to those things verbally. They were encouraged that he tweeted publicly about it. But the one thing that they kept hammering home is that we will judge him by his deeds, not his actions, or by not his words. And so, you know, I think they're still very much in wait and see mode as to whether he lives up to those promises.
Because he's been known to change his mind, yes?
He certainly has, yeah, including about whether he wanted to acquire Twitter.
Well, exactly. Was he forced? Let me toss something back to you, Issy. Was he forced into this by a Delaware court?
This had not gone through the full, you know, hearing process yet, but he clearly he had his back up against a wall. You know, he didn't really have much standing to back out of this thing. You know, he was waving his hands all about bots and all of these things that Twitter had withheld from him. But, you know, it was clear that this was kind of an act of desperation. So I think, you know, for Twitter shareholders, at least, it was certainly a big win that in the end, Twitter was able to get him to buy the company at the original purchase price, especially given everything that's happened in the economy.
And Will, I mentioned in my introduction that most analysts feel like he overpaid for Twitter at $44 billion. Does anyone know what it's actually worth?
There's no way to know exactly what it would be worth on the open market because, you know, people have been trading the stock with the expectation that there was a good chance Musk would end up having to buy it at that agreed upon price. But we can make some inferences based on what has happened to the stock of other major social media platforms over the same time period. So if you look at the year-to-date stock performance of Meta, which owns Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, it is less than half of where it started the year. If you look at Snap, the owner of Snapchat, its stock is worth a fraction of what it was worth to start the year. I've heard a ballpark estimate for Twitter of maybe it's worth $25 billion now instead of the $44 billion that Musk paid for it. I think that might actually be a little high.
Really?
Might be a little optimistic. But it's probably worth half or less of the amount that he ended up feeling like he had to pay for it. Again, not because, as he said, not because the Delaware court had ruled that he had to pay for it, but because he saw the writing on the wall and decided sort of at the last minute before the trial and before he was going to be deposed under oath that he would go ahead and buy it.
Let me just read a couple of comments here. A tweet from Mick who says, a hypocritical mess that will have people leaving a company that needs a union. And let me toss that back to you, Will. Is there, you know, has that ever been an issue for Twitter employees to unionize?
Tech companies historically in Silicon Valley have not been unionized. They are places where employees tend to be very well compensated. They get lots of perks, lots of benefits. Tech employees in the past haven't, you know, generally been motivated to do unionization efforts. Now, that's been changing in recent years. And one of the interesting things is that the reason it's been changing is not necessarily because the workers want better pay or better benefits. It's because they want a collective voice in the direction of their companies. They see their leaders making decisions that they find problematic or unethical, and they want to be able to negotiate on those things as a union. So it's sort of a different motivation for unionizing from what we traditionally think of in terms of, you know, trying to get a living wage or that sort of thing. But those movements have been sort of on the margins of the tech industry so far. There have been a few companies that have tried to unionize. One of my former employees, Medium, which is a site where people can post blogs and such, they tried to unionize. We tried to unionize and lost by one vote. You know, it is something that's a trend, but it hasn't gotten to the point where any of the big tech companies have actually unionized. And we've seen we've seen some faint hints of collective action from Twitter workers since Musk took over, but nothing serious to this point.
Well, we are talking about Elon Musk, his purchase of Twitter last week, what he has done in the last week since he bought the company, and talking with Will Oremus. He's technology reporter for The Washington Post. Issy Lepowski, chief correspondent for Protocol, covering the intersection of technology, politics, and national affairs. And if you want to join us, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can do it the old-fashioned way. You can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You see, there's something like 240 million Twitter users around the world. Is there any evidence, and it's only been a week, that they're going to stay, they're going to go, that they have opinions about whether Musk owns the company or not, or whatever he does with the company? Are they all addicts, I guess, is what I'm also asking.
There are a whole lot of Twitter addicts. Yes, I think it's telling that a lot of the conversation about Twitter's layoffs and how Twitter's going to turn into a hellscape have been playing out on Twitter. But there certainly is a movement to move to other platforms. Mastodon is one more sort of distributed social network that has been seeing a huge uptick in signups. I think the challenge is that, you know, there aren't necessarily great other options for an alternative to Twitter. I mean, something like Mastodon kind of has a learning curve for signing up. It's a little bit more, it requires a little bit more tech savvy. Even Twitter is, you know, kind of has a learning curve. That's been a major challenge for Twitter over the years, and arguably one reason why they haven't achieved the scale that Facebook has is because, you know, the average person who's not necessarily a public figure or a journalist or part of some, you know, niche community doesn't necessarily know what they're supposed to do on Twitter sometimes. So Twitter has worked for a long time to, you know, make it easier to figure out who to follow and all of those things. But I think one upside for Elon, I guess, is that, you know, it's going to be hard for people to find an alternative. But you did mention the point about this being, you know, a global platform. And I think that's really important. Some of the changes that Elon plans to make are potentially, you know, going to be the most disruptive for people around the world, where, you know, the risk of political violence and hate speech, you know, can sort of boil over in different ways. I mean, we've certainly seen the ways that they can boil over in the U.S., but I think you do have a higher risk factor in other countries around the world. And as you move away from, you know, the verification of public figures and political leaders, unless they pay for it, you could potentially get a lot more impersonation, a lot more misinformation and disinformation, and a lot more confusion about who's saying what in really heated circumstances.
And you know, a lot of journalists use Twitter. I've been giving out our Twitter handle here on Radio Times. You're on Twitter. Issy is on Twitter.
Yes, it's, you know, so Twitter is not one of the top five most popular social media platforms. And so whenever I have written about Twitter in the past, I get readers saying, who cares about Twitter? I don't use Twitter. It's a waste of time. And I get that. I actually think for most people, Twitter doesn't have a lot of value because your friends aren't on there for the most part. It's not really set up as a place to keep in touch with friends and family. What it's really set up for are for people who have an audience, whether they're a politician or public figure, an activist, a journalist, a celebrity, to reach that audience in real time and also to interact with other public figures in their field. And journalism is one of those fields. I think we as journalists tend to sometimes overstate the importance of journalists on Twitter. Certainly it is important to the news that people get around the country and around the world because journalists are discussing the topics of the day on there and hearing from each other. There is a sort of consensus formation and challenges to that consensus that happen on Twitter and that filter down through other media channels. But I should say Twitter is also a place where leaders in many, many other fields convene to talk about the big talking points of the day. I mean, it's a water cooler for the pundits of the sports world. It's a water cooler for the top macroeconomists, for marine biologists. I mean, people in all different fields use Twitter to sort of keep up with and argue about the hot button issues in their areas.
I ran across this quote in preparation for today's show from activist and artist Ai Weiwei. This was, I think, in 2010. He said, and I'm quoting here, Twitter is the people's tool, the tool of ordinary people, people who have no other resources. And it's interesting, Will, to take that quote and then to think now Twitter's owned by the richest man in the world.
Yeah, and let me go back and modify what I just said, which
sure.
is it is used by sort of the elites in many different fields, but it is also a place where if you are a person without power, an ordinary person, Twitter is set up in such a way that you can speak your truth to those powerful people. Right? It doesn't prevent, you know, on Facebook, you can't just friend Elon Musk and start talking to him, but you can tweet back at Elon Musk and he might see what you have to say. And that is something I think almost new in the world. It's like, you know, I'm trying to find a historical analog. I guess it's like if the king and queen were going by and you could shout something at their carriage, you know, as they passed. Like, Twitter lets you talk. It lets you, in fact, shout in the face of the world's most powerful and influential people. And so if you're an activist, if you're trying to build a movement, Twitter can be critical to that. And that's why we've seen Twitter play a significant role in movements from the Arab Spring more than a decade ago to, in the United States, Me Too, the coverage of the Ferguson protests and Black Lives Matter and the George Floyd protests. It really is a place for social movements as well.
Well, and I'm glad you said that, Will. And Issy, I'll toss it to you. I mean, this feels like, you know, ancient history, I guess, when it comes to digital years. But I think I was first aware of the power of Twitter with the Arab Spring and how it was used by pro-democracy activists to fight against, you know, their autocratic regimes.
Yeah, I think that was sort of the most optimistic period in the history of social media, when we really saw these platforms be used as a tool for lifting up the voices of average people against the very powerful forces in our country. And that was a really optimistic time. And since then, we've seen how the same rules apply, where you can lift up the voices of average people en masse, and not always to the best effect. You can lift it up for the purposes of driving misinformation and disinformation and hate speech and Stop the Steal movement here in the U.S., which turns into an effort to thwart the election results. And so I think it's really interesting how we've seen the best parts of social media and the best parts of Twitter sort of get turn rotten
because it's so easy to misuse the site that's so open to free speech.
Exactly. And I think people have really sort of learned how the playbook works and have manipulated it in a lot of ways, which is not to say that it doesn't still provide that very important service as a vehicle for human rights activists to speak out and all of those things. But I think we've seen the good and the bad that comes with that.
Well, let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Issy Lipowski, again, chief correspondent for Protocol, Will Oremus, technology reporter for The Washington Post. We are talking about the fact that Elon Musk bought Twitter just a week ago, has already laid off executive staff. He's in the process of laying off what could be half of the company's workers today. And again, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with our guests about Elon Musk and Twitter. Well, let me put a comment from Diana, who says, California's WARN law requires Twitter to give you 60 days notice of a massive layoff. A layoff of 50-plus employees within a 30-day period qualifies. Already employees are suing. Is that correct?
It's very murky. We're actually working on trying to nail down the details as we speak. You know, because Musk faces this enormous and immediate financial pressure due to overpaying for Twitter and taking on a bunch of debt to do so, he has to cut costs any way he can. And one of the ways that we know he's been trying to do that is to minimize the payouts to the people he's firing and laying off. Mm-hmm. So he's had his legal team, as we understand it, working on ways to avoid, say, paying the so-called golden parachutes, the payouts of tens of millions to the company's top executives that their contracts said they would be owed. He's also, you know, of course, looking for how can he pay the least that is legally required to the many employees that he is laying off right now. To the California employees, we are hearing from at least a couple laid off employees this morning that maybe the approach will be to keep them on the payroll for 60 more days. So they technically remain employees of Twitter and get pay and benefits, but they are no longer allowed to work and are locked out of all the company offices and tools. That may be how they're approaching that in California. It may be different for workers in other states. And again, this is all we're working on figuring this out while we're on the radio here.
Fair enough. Here's a comment from Julie. I'll put this to you, Issy. She says, could Musk be deliberately tanking Twitter for some reason? He's clearly a smart guy, but he's acting like a maniac.
I would doubt if he was deliberately tanking Twitter. I mean, some might say that all of the things he's said about what he plans to do with Twitter mean that he is going to tank Twitter. But I would say that this isn't necessarily unlike Musk to sort of come in, rule as a dictator, you know, have people sleeping in the office overnight and having to ship things, you know, in a week and all of those, you know, tight deadlines and, you know, sort of, I guess, borderline brutal behaviors are sort of, you know, all that we've ever heard about the culture inside his other companies. So I think this is sort of the way Musk works. I don't think anybody can take away from him that he's had tremendous success in business. And so I'm not sure it's for me to say behind my keyboard whether or not he knows what he's doing in terms of saving the business of Twitter. I can speak to, you know, what is best for, you know, sort of online safety and the broader discourse on Twitter. But, you know, he has a lot of success in business. So I don't think anyone can take that away from him.
No, fair enough. Well, here's a sort of related question. I mean, my understanding, he's been on Twitter since 2009. So he's been, a longtime Twitter user himself. Does he understand, as you see it, does he understand this platform as such a avid user of it?
I think he understands the platform extremely well through his own lens on it. I mean, because he is an avid user, he understands the way people talk, right? The lingo, the way people interact, the memes. And he understands the mechanisms of amplification and virality. I mean, we talked earlier about the impossibility of a neutral social media platform. One of the reasons that no social media platform is neutral is because it has software that decides what people see at the top of their feeds. And it takes in all kinds of data and metrics to figure out what those posts should be that get circulated widely versus the ones that sort of, you know, die in a forest with nobody around. And Musk understands how to take advantage of those algorithms. He knows, for instance, that if he wants to amplify something that is said by someone else on Twitter without him having to directly retweet or endorse it, he can just reply to them. And then his millions of followers, I think he has more than 100 million followers on the platform, many of them will see both his reply and the original tweet, even if they didn't follow the original person. So yes, he has mastered the platform in some ways. He is in some ways like Donald Trump. I mean, he understands that on social media, all engagement is good engagement. You know, if people are happy with your post and they like it and share it, that will make sure it gets seen more widely. If people are outraged by your post and they reply angrily or they quote tweet it to denounce it, that will make it get seen more widely. I mean, this is part of why social media is such a sort of polarized and divisive environment. What I will say is that he has a very unique lens on Twitter. His lens on Twitter comes from being one of the most followed users on the platform. He gets tons of spam and bots in his mentions that ordinary users don't see. And so he may have an outsized impression of how big an issue those kinds of things are for the average user.
Well, and speaking of Donald Trump, Issy, let me go back to you. He was, I believe, suspended from Twitter after the January 6th insurrection. How significant will be whether Elon Musk lets him back on or keeps him off?
Well, I think it's hugely significant because it sets a precedent for Twitter in terms of, you know, what they are willing to tolerate in their user base. It's hugely significant because of what Donald Trump was able to accomplish on Twitter during the time he was on Twitter. And arguably, he accomplished becoming president of the United States in large part because of his ability to tweet. If he runs for re-election, it is certainly going to be a vehicle that I think he's likely to return to, even though he says he won't. The one caveat is that, you know, Donald Trump hasn't necessarily needed Twitter to continue to be an incredibly powerful force in the Republican Party since January 6th. I mean, look at the midterms. Sure. and you know, the effectiveness of his cosign on various candidates. So, you know, he has maintained his power in the party without Twitter. So I would say that it's certainly going to be a more mainstream channel for him, and it might bring him back into the lives of a lot of folks who have not been paying attention to him and every little thing he says. But he hasn't gone anywhere without Twitter.
But he doesn't get that immediacy that you get from Twitter, though, right? Is he?
Yeah, and he doesn't necessarily get the same call and response from the media. I think to the point that Will was making about the way journalists use this, it's true that, you know, most average people don't get much utility out of Twitter, but they don't necessarily know the ways in which they're on the receiving end of what's happening on Twitter. During Donald Trump's presidency, every tweet, you know, was immediately responded to by a whole bunch of media outlets, including the most, you know, mainstream and powerful media outlets in the country. And so that, you know, the impact of, you know, Trump's tweets being on cable news or on the nightly news or in the New York Times on the front page or the Washington Post, you know, that has a huge ripple effect. And so it's exactly right that I think if he returns to Twitter, we're going to see that call and response return.
Let me read an email from Stu, and Will, I'll put this to you. Stu says the largest investor in Musk's Twitter is the Saudi royal family. He then says free speech, ! Nonsense, ! Is that true? Do you know?
Well, the largest investor in Twitter is Elon Musk. yes, outside investor. Yeah, they have a significant stake. My understanding, and I'm not an expert on this, but my understanding is that the Saudi royal family had that same stake in Twitter before Musk took it over and has now rolled it over and has a stake in it now that it's a private company under Musk. I don't think that I have the expertise to speak to, you know, exactly what say that gives them or any further details.
Here's an email from Ron who says there are foreign reporters and news sources who have no voice in American broadcast media, saying that Twitter is a direct source of information. I don't care who follows me, but I want to get information directly from them, a reason to use Twitter. And I just want to put that out there. Also, Craig says, I rarely use or look at Twitter. It's like yelling or complaining into a void. No one I know uses Twitter. And Craig is certainly not alone. There are 240 million people in the world that use Twitter, which means that most people do not. Here's a question from Vanessa. People are saying a lot of negative things about Twitter, but when push comes to shove, are there any influential people actually going to get off it? And I think that is an interesting question, Issy, about whether, you know, people might be complaining about Elon Musk's ownership of Twitter, but will they leave the site or not?
I guess I just wonder the same myself. You know, we might see this like sort of mass exodus, but if it isn't mass enough, if there's still a lot going on Twitter, you might see people return. So it will be really hard to check those numbers, because I think something that we've also seen is, as Musk discussed taking over the platform, a lot of people who weren't previously on Twitter coming onto Twitter or becoming active on Twitter. Right after Musk announced he was going to buy the company, a whole bunch of conservative politicians said, whoa, I just saw my follower base, you know, grow, you know, like it's never grown before. So I think it's going to be really hard to measure how big the delete Twitter movement has been. I think we'll see certain individuals try to jump ship. But I guess I question if it's only a matter of time before they return, if they're sort of out on their own.
What do you think about that, Will?
Yeah, you know, I think that what happens to the usership of Twitter is still very much up in the air. But certainly, you know, you can see in the metrics that conservatives in the United States have seen their follower counts go up. Liberals have seen their follower counts go down. Musk says, you know, he often makes noises about sort of wanting to be centrist or moderate. He has said that if you are pissing off the most extreme 10% on either side of the spectrum, you're probably doing a good job. But almost all of his statements that do have a partisan bent seem to please the right and displease the left. And so I think we will see the tenor of Twitter in the United States shift a little bit. I want to go back to something that has come up a couple times in this conversation, which is the global nature of Twitter. The U.S. is the largest single market for Twitter. But something that's so easy to forget is that a small minority of all Twitter users are in the United States. I think it's about 15-17% of Twitter users are in the U.S. Japan is the second largest market. India is third. So Twitter is so much more than U.S. Twitter. And I think Musk's statements about content moderation and his, you know, what he'll do with Twitter in terms of free speech and politics so far have actually been quite U.S.-centric. And I think that he will discover as he goes on running this platform that there are issues that have nothing to do with U.S. politics that are critical to Twitter and to its future.
Rick has a question, and I'll put it to you. He says, does the FCC have any role to play in regulating social media platforms?
Let's see. I guess the answer should be yes, and they're certainly thinking of ways to do it. I think we would be talking more about the FTC, which has, you know, certainly been a lot more active in thinking about the ways that they can regulate, you know, privacy on social media and things and deceptive practices on social media. But there's certainly a lot of regulatory interest in oversight of social media, not just at the federal level, but at the state level. We've seen laws passed in Texas and in Florida that are being contested in the courts that would dictate, you know, what social media platforms can and can't moderate. We're seeing laws passed all over the world in Europe and in countries like India that dictate what platforms have to take down and what kind of notice and appeals they have to get from users. So suffice to say, if it's not the FCC, it's a lot of other regulators around the world.
Well, that gets us, Will, to Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. Why is that significant?
Yeah, so Section 230 was an obscure statute when it was first passed in 1996 as part of a broader Telecommunications Act. The goal of Section 230 was to try to facilitate the growth of the internet by immunizing websites from being held liable for stuff that their users post. Mm-hmm. So if I run a website, like back then it was like CompuServe and Prodigy and AOL, right? If I ran one of those, if you were a company running a site where users could come and post stuff, you wouldn't be treated as the person speaking the things your users posted. So if somebody posted something that was libelous or defamed someone, you could say, well, I can't get sued for that. And that really enabled the growth of social media, because if companies could be sued as the speaker of anything their users say, social media as we know it today basically wouldn't exist. It would just be too much of a liability issue. So there have been calls in recent years as concern has grown about the effects of social media on our body politic and on our culture and discourse to maybe revisit Section 230, maybe reform it, maybe hold social media companies or websites liable for certain types of content. We saw that a few years ago with a bill called SESTA FOSTA that said if there's any type of content that facilitates prostitution, then the platforms could be held liable for hosting that. So there are many efforts afoot from both the left and the right to try to reform Section 230 and restore a little bit of liability to these platforms. But it's a fraught issue because, as I said, social media really relies on this immunity in order to be able to host the speech of ordinary users.
And you see, we're almost out of time here. As the day ticks on, what will you be looking for when it comes to Twitter and its employees?
I'm looking for, you know, more stories about the specific terms under which all of these employees are being laid off. You know, how is this affecting contractors? Are they getting the same benefits as full-time employees? What is life going to be like for the people who are left behind? I'm sure there are some folks who are really jazzed about working for Elon and some folks who maybe wish that they had gotten laid off so they got some severance and could move on from this whole mess. So I'm really interested in the stories of, you know, the individual people at the center of this. And of course, to continue watching, you know, as these new features and new fees get rolled out to users on Twitter.
Well, we have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Issy Lipowski, thanks for coming on the show once again.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And she's chief correspondent for Protocol. And Will Arimus, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Enjoyed the conversation. Thanks.
Me too. Learned a lot as well, which we always like on Radio Times. And he's technology reporter for The Washington Post. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.